Do I get to kill the English? Excellent.
It's my island.
Live from the Mundangerous Bazaar in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 132 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about emerging from behind the GM screen and rolling in the open. But first, the Rogue Traders unbox a present in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the Holy Roller keeps it medicinal in the Character Creation Forge. So, Shane, let's move right into Dynasty Unwarranted. Where in the heck are we? Besides a terrible planet, because that's where we always are. A terrible planet or the warp?
So, the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Warhammer 40k Rogue Trader game played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules by Fantasy Flight Games. And the Rogue Traders have returned an Imperial Reliquary to Lord Captain Duhan Roth on the surface of the Desert World Malajacked.
He was so thankful and was like, oh my god, have so much money, and also that time you screwed me over, all is forgiven, and also you can leave, right?
You hoped he would do that, but did he?
He didn't. No, of course he did. Of course he didn't. No.
No, instead, you received very sharp orders from an Ordo Hereticus Inquisitor.
Who is 14 years old.
Yeah, and a very powerful psyker herself.
So, we're going to do what she says.
Yeah. So, you had some rogue traderly banter with Lord Captain Roth. And then, as soon as you produced the reliquary itself and everyone saw it, she said, good, it's time to get to work. Come with me.
I hate working for the Inquisition.
Yeah, no one likes to work for the Inquisition, except the Inquisition.
So we are unsure if we're about to be killed or given a big reward, or to be honest, maybe both.
Right. The big reward is you get killed quickly.
Yes, honor comes in death.
Right. The Emperor thanks you for your service. Only in death does duty end. Importantly here, No one among you is brave enough or foolish enough to cross an Inquisitor, so you're along for the ride here.
Yeah, it's important for us to note that Roth is also like, yep, gonna do what she says.
Yeah, and not to mention, there's still another figure that you haven't identified yet standing beside the Inquisitor and Roth, who is cloaked, but large and hulking and clearly clad in power armor.
Gee, who could he be?
Yeah, how could this get worse? The tiny Inquisitor with a powerful psychic mind also has a bodyguard.
Yay. So we head deeper into the bunker and we're escorted to a war room on a lower level where she tells the adjutant to Roth, the guy who's like too cool for school, like the desperado, tell her men to set up camp. And so, you know, we do the same thing with our men. She also tells the cogitator operators to get out. And also the Vox officers. So, yay.
Yeah, so she clears out the war room.
The witnesses.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just your rogue traders, the Lord Captain, and this cloaked figure remaining, along with a apparently very powerful but very young Ordo Hereticus Inquisitor.
Okay, so then she takes the reliquary and drops it on the table. How does she do that? Because we saw two giant chaos space marines struggle to carry the thing between the two of them.
Yeah, and I mean, when you guys carried it out from the Ambition, the ship that you recovered it from, it took two of you. And you really actually struggled even to get it out of the chapel as it was rapidly decompressing. It took two armsmen to carry it even here on Malajacked planet side to get it into this war room, and she just picked it up casually and set it on a table.
Maybe I don't want to know.
Yeah. I mean, reliquaries are very powerful objects, so you
who knows? It's like a unicorn, and it's she's like a virgin.
It's like the Emperor protects.
Then she turns to the cloaked figure in the giant power armor and says, "Interrogator Chaplain."
God damn it.
Yeah, so he steps forward, leaves his robes behind, and reveals the jet black power armor and the legendary badges of the Dark Angels, the first legion of the Astartes, the Imperial Space Marines.
Yeah, it's a freaking Space Marine. This is our first Space Marine, isn't it?
This is your first loyalist
an actual Space Marine. Yeah. Right.
And he is wielding the gigantic scepter, capped by the Dark Angels, like Angel of Death icon. It's sort of a skull with wings.
Like everything.
Like everything in 40K, yeah. And he wields this, and you realize, a chaplain of the Dark Angels, an interrogator chaplain, no less, a pretty important Space Marine, right? But he takes the scepter and inserts it into a locking mechanism on the reliquary, something that you hadn't even really noticed was a lock. And as he does that, it slides open with a click and reveals a different mechanism, a second mechanism.
And then the tiny Inquisitor steps forward, takes off her rosette from her neck, and puts that into the lock, which also turns with a click. The lid depressurizes, and it opens.
And what do you find inside, Ishan?
A stupid book. It's a stupid book. It's not guns. It's not a pirate cache.
It's not some psychically active object that would be, very magnifying to Flare's power.
Nope.
No pirate weapons that may or may not be Necron weapons.
Not even a force sword. It's just a book.
No Inferno pistol. No plasma rifle.
Man, what a waste, I say to no one.
Right. What it is a large ancient tome. It is, very finely bound and the finest imperial materials, which are, of course, some combination of leather and gold and probably steel. It is covered in Dark Angels iconography, and then on the face of it is a relief, sort of an engraving of a scepter, similar to the one that the interrogator chaplain is carrying, except it's a little bit different. And this is sort of the first time as you look at it and then look at his and look at it and look at his that you realize something special about his scepter. The cover has 8 black pearls socketed into it, and they are actual black pearls. When you look at the interrogator chaplain's scepter, you see he has 3 black pearls socketed into his.
And so he reaches in, grabs the book, and finally speaks. And he says, "This holds the secret."
And we'll find out how deadly that secret is next week.
So this week, we're talking about rolling in the open. Previously, we have talked about fudging the dice. So, you're rolling behind the DM screen, I think, as is typical for most games. And, maybe you change what's on them. This time, we're talking about the opposite. You, along with all of the players, so the GM is rolling the dice in front of everyone. It's much, much harder to tweak things as they go. We kind of call this playing it where it lies.
Right. Yeah, so for a long time, RPGs sort of put up a wall between the GM and the players. And it was a literal wall because it was the GM screen, right? So you would keep your notes in your books. And
but who paid for that wall?
But you would keep your notes and your books and all of your dice and your rolls and your outcomes hidden behind that, and then just sort of explain what happened to all of the players. And I think that's the way that probably most groups continue to play today. But I think as games have evolved over time, the role of the GM and the players has also changed with it. So more games are more collaborative. There's a lot of sharing narrative control. Decisions about how dice outcomes are interpreted are now sort of shared across the GM and the players. So in some ways, like, that DM screen has sort of become a relic of the past for some games.
Yeah, I think also with the rise of OSR games, the old school Renaissance, you have more people these days who sort of remember fondly the days when combat was extremely deadly. And so we're going to roll out in front of everyone, and like, if you get critted and you die, that's right. What happens,
right? So yeah, today we're going to talk about another way to sort of help tear down the wall between GMs and players. And that's, as you described, rolling in the open, showing your dice to everybody.
So for those who haven't ever played this way, how do you go about doing it? What does it look like at the table?
I mean, it's simple. You can still keep your screen if you need to hide your notes or whatever, but it's basically just whenever you need dice, you pick them up and you roll them in front of you where they can be seen. You don't necessarily need to like highlight what the roll was or do the math or anything like that. You just roll them so they're public and then interpret the results for everyone at the table.
Yeah, you're basically rolling in that, you know, communal space that sort of ends up forming in the middle of a table where everyone's kind of rolling their dice.
Right.
So that's easy. That's simple. Let's just do that and we're done.
Yeah, it's simple, right? Like nothing is that different afterwards, or is it?
Well, maybe a couple things change.
Okay, so what changes?
Well, first off, it's trust. The trust is now explicit rather than implicit. The players no longer have to wonder if the GM is quote-unquote playing fair. It means that you as a GM aren't going to be able to do any kind of heavy-handed fudging.
Yeah, the one in a thousand shot that, you know, you just, oh my God, I can't believe I happened to roll it this way, that you have to sell your players on, you're not going to be able to do that anymore because they're going to see the dice.
It also means as a GM, you've got to give up the idea that you can control a lot of the minutiae of the game.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you can't fudge as easily, so more of the narrative is out of human hands and put into the randomness of the dice, right? So you just have to be ready to roll with those punches.
Yeah, and depending on the system that you're using, sometimes the randomness of those dice is a much broader spectrum than
yeah.
might be easy for your game.
I will tell you, I mean, because I do this for 40K for Rogue Trader, a decent amount of time, and there are definitely fights where it's like, man, I blew the first roll, and like, I'm not sure if my big bad is going to get a turn anymore. Like, the death spiral is real.
That's because that's how we built our characters.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It can also really up the engagement at the table, because the players are now extremely involved in what's happening on the GM's turn. They're literally looking at the GM as they roll the dice, and everyone is watching the dice land.
Yeah, if you have a flair for dramatic, this is great, right? Because you can use the dice rolling to build tension, because, you know, players will see the outcome of the dice but not know what it necessarily means. So if they see, you know, you rolled a 20 or you rolled a 1, like, well, what is that going to mean for the game, right? I'm waiting for the result to be told to me, even though I know it has to be either this direction or that direction. Or if you roll something very middle, it could be a borderline case and they don't know, did we succeed or fail? What's going on?
Also, you'll be able to see exactly who's paying attention, because when you're going to grab that fistful of dice and plop them in the middle of the table, you'll see whose eyes are following your hand.
Yeah, there's a fun little trick here when you like, when you're rolling fireball damage, like this is one that Angelo does to us in Dark Sun, where he's like, he'll like count them loudly, and he doesn't use a GM screen, right? So he'll like count them, and he'll be like, "Hey, can I borrow 2d6s?" And then and everyone is like, "Wait a minute, what?"
Oh, wait, I need two more. Sorry, I just counted.
Oh yeah, sorry. No, I need a couple more. And then he'll just take a fistful of dice and drop them.
He'll shake them for a bit first, right? He'll just be like looking at the battle map, and he's thinking, and he's like, and just shaking, you know, 11d6.
Right.
And we're just like, come on.
And then he's like, oh yeah, I mean, that was a fireball. Like, also 41 damage. Right, roll a save.
Right. Oh yeah, did I mention it's a fireball?
Right. it really does drive engagement. There are also some things that don't change. Keep in mind, you're still the GM, so you ultimately still have to interpret dice. You decide what a roll means, even though the number is out of your control and is now publicly visible, the interpretation of what that number means for your story and for your world is still entirely on you.
Right, you're always deciding what does a 17 arcana check mean.
Exactly.
In game terms. You're still doing that.
Right.
Adjudication doesn't really change either. You still have to choose when you're going to roll or when things just happen. So it doesn't matter if you're rolling in the open. If this is a plot point that is just going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And then you're also still responsible for all of the other things that GMs do.
Wait,
right?
Do they do other things? Yeah, you just roll dice and announce damage.
Exactly. Oh no, that was a trap. No, you don't. What? You didn't have enough passive perception. It's fine.
It was roll poison damage. No, cold damage.
Right.
Cold and radiant.
Yeah, but as the GM, you still have the other responsibilities, right? You're directing the spotlight amongst the players and sharing that. You are building a narrative that's trying to, you know, tell a story or challenge a moral quandary. You're the one making the PCs the star of the show. Like, just because you're rolling dice in the public now, like, you can't just introduce a DM PC or have your NPCs sort of steal the spotlight from the players, right? You still have all the other responsibilities of a GM and all of the other things that you have to manage in a combat, right? Those don't go away just because you're rolling out in the open. They're still there.
So we've established that fudging what a role means for the sake of the story, or guiding the game through careful use of narrative control, it doesn't end when you're rolling out in the open. But how does it differ? How do you continue to do it in a way that facilitates the story at the table?
So normally when you fudge dice, right, you roll them behind the screen and you just ignore what they say and you decide what the outcome is, right? Oh yeah, no, I rolled a 22, of course. I mean, yeah, it hits, right?
Haven't been hit in a while. This is getting boring.
Exactly. Like, let me just throw some damage at you, right? Obviously that doesn't work as well anymore because you can't just obscure the roll entirely. But you do have some ways that you can ensure that you still have subtle control of what's going on, so it's not totally random, because no one wants totally random. They want a coherent narrative and a fun escalating story, right?
Yeah, occasionally you shout, "Oh my god, what's that?" And then you point out the window, and when everyone turns to look, you change the dice.
Okay, yeah. I guess I didn't leave any mechanical tricks in here. but sure, I mean,
it's like, you remember Ocean's 11, right? You get loaded dice. Loaded this dice. Is the opportunity for loaded dice. No, those are mine. Those are mine. I don't want you to curse them.
Right. Yeah, okay. All right. So short being an actual literal dice cheat, what are some ways that you can still fudge while rolling in the open?
Well, like we said, you can obscure the meaning of the roll. You are the only one who knows what an 11 or a 17 or a 45 or a 3 under 40 means.
Oh, I'll do you one better, Ishan. You're the only one who knows why you rolled a die in the first place. There's no reason that you have to declare that up front, right? Like, you don't have to say, okay, the enemy is attacking you, Ishan. Like, I am targeting Draco. Like, I don't have to tell you that. I can just roll dice and say, does an 18 hit your AC? Because I rolled an 18. Like, that 18 could have been a perception check or a stealth check or whatever it needed to be before I rolled it, until I declare it.
Also, players don't know the bonuses that are in effect in any given moment.
Right.
Yes, I rolled a 7. On this roll, they had a plus 24 to hit.
Right. You do have to be careful about that, because players will get a sense of what numbers hit and which don't.
Right. If it's normally a plus 11, 24 isn't going to cut it.
Right. another trick is that you can resolve multiple actions with multiple dice rolls at the same time. So if you roll a set of dice, you're helping to obscure which die goes to which roll. So you can just narrate everything that happens at once based on the sum of the dice rather than having to resolve each one individually.
Yeah, that was a great attack roll, an excellent saving throw, but they did pretty poorly on their nature check to figure out how humans taste. So they're still going to try to bite you because they don't know. They have no idea.
They don't know that humans are poisonous.
Yeah.
Wait, they're not? Man, I really blew it.
I get just claw claw.
I mean, that's also true, especially like D&D where you have multi-attack, right? It's always easier to just roll a lot of attacks at once because you can sum them up. But, you know, if you have two claws and a bite and the bite has some follow-on effect, right? You can make sure the bite lands by rolling the claws with it and making sure the highest one was the bite.
Yeah, you're just replacing the technique of rolling behind the screen, but still obfuscating the actual meaning of the dice. You just happen to have players who can see a number on the table.
Right. And this is just like fudging the dice. you don't want to do this on every roll, right? Like, in fact, the majority of rolls probably aren't consequential enough that you would want to cheat. But if you need to spice up an encounter or you need something to land, you can kind of quickly give yourself, put the odds back in your favor of getting an outcome that you want.
Yeah. As an aside, Shane, did you, like, you spend a lot of time on Reddit. I spend a lot of time on Reddit. Did you know that there's like an extremely vocal community of gamers on Reddit, like D&D gamers on Reddit, who hate the idea of ever fudging dice for any reason?
I am kind of one of those people. I mean, I wouldn't say that I'm vocal about it, but I kind of do hate fudging dice. Like, when I have to fudge dice, I feel bad.
But I mean, it's a bit like being in a libertarian subreddit where it's like, right, you are very philosophically wedded to this.
Right, yeah, you've chosen this hill to die on.
Yes. You have a position and it has neither been tested extensively.
But you are very, very yes, convinced that it's right. 100%
sure of yeah. this, yes. And, you know, I say this as a person who, like, I get where that is coming from, totally. And, like, we talked about how Angelo in Dark Sun rolls in front of everyone. And he does that specifically because Dark Sun is a game where we all decided that it was going to be pretty lethal. Characters were going to die. It was going to be a story about the company of adventurers and not any particular set of adventurers.
Right. But, well, we decided that after enough adventurers died.
But we always knew it was going to be gritty.
Right.
And when Angelo ran a 4E game, he wasn't rolling in front of people.
Right.
You know, he was doing the traditional, it wasn't a DM screen, but like over on his other table, you know, where we wouldn't necessarily be seeing his dice.
Yeah, I mean, I think Angelo felt that he didn't have permission to kill our characters, but we had all agreed that the dice had permission to kill our characters, so he was going to at least make the dice transparent.
Yeah, that is a great thing to consider, is if you find yourself being a typically lenient GM, and you either have players say, you know, I think we can spice this up, I think what we want is a little more danger, like, don't be afraid of that, but you still have, like, this guilt, or you're just not sure when exactly to do it, you can do it in front of the screen, and, like, when the dice say a character dies, a character dies.
Yep.
So getting back to, you know, fudging and narrative control, you all do also want to make sure that you aren't setting up stakes that are pass-fail, especially when it's much harder to fudge. You know, if you know that, like, if they don't get past this one enemy, then there's no other way through because for some reason that's how you, like, built this dungeon.
Right.
Well, you kind of have to make sure that they get through or else the story is over and you've got to start all over and it's a TPK and, you know, everyone go home.
Yeah, if you know that you can't cheat the role when it really matters, then you have to make sure you design a session, if not a story, that has those types of fail-safes so yeah. that there's always a way forward.
Yeah, now, you want to do that no matter what, but there's just less leeway for error when you're rolling in front of the screen.
Right. So, if you've never rolled dice openly in front of your players before, Ishan, what are some tips for trying it for the first time?
I mean, be prepared for some strange looks, right? Because, you know, if you're going like au naturel, then a lot of your players are going to be like, that seems inappropriate, and I feel like I'm seeing more of you than I want to see.
Okay. Yes.
But, and then you just be like, well, this is very European.
Right. And then pull out your dice.
Just whip out your dice and put them on the table.
Jesus. So, in terms of actionable advice, I think I would recommend starting with, like, a very dramatic moment with probably a binary outcome, right? Like, right on the heels of saying don't set up a pass-fail, set up a pass-fail where everyone sees that the die roll is going to determine the outcome, right? And make the stakes very, very clear. You know, if you roll 6 or better, the good thing happens. If you roll 5 or less, the bad thing happens. And the key to that, though, is knowing in advance what the two outcomes are going to be, right? Which direction the story is going to go.
Yeah, as long as you, in your mind there is a clear path for the story afterward, then it doesn't matter which way it goes. Something interesting is going to happen. So, you know, the you're in a climactic battle over lava, and, you know, and someone hits the evil wizard who's, like, holding the phylactery. Okay, do they drop it or not? Let's roll out in the open and we'll see. If they drop it, maybe it lands in the lava.
Right.
And a thing happens. If they don't drop it and they hold on to it, maybe they escape with it and a thing happens.
Right.
But everyone's going to see, and everyone's going to be hanging on that roll.
Yeah, speaking of dramatically dropping things, what if your players are in a gun cutter carrying a damaged drop pod through gale force winds?
You trust to your min-maxed player to be able to make it through the storm?
So this is an actual scenario that I set up. It was probably the first time that I really like made it clear that I was rolling in the open for you guys in Rogue Trader. But I literally, like, you know, we had some skill checks that were made, and we that determined the odds. And then I said, look, here's what you've done overall. This single die roll is going to determine the outcome. Are you successfully navigating the storm, or are you going down at sea? And it turned out that, you know, with a 60% chance, you did succeed, and we didn't have a very, very nautical adventure after that.
Is this thing waterproof?
But that was sort of the turning point of the campaign, right? Like, because it would have been you guys lost at sea had you failed. And you didn't, so you ended up back, and you ended up in a land war against orcs, so there's that.
I'm so glad we didn't get lost at sea, because the only thing I wanted to do, the only thing Trank wanted to do was get off Gontal Grim.
Right.
Back in the Navy?
Wait, this Navy is way worse than the Imperial Navy. It's wet. So then in terms of trying it for the first time, right, like I said, you want to announce the stakes to the players, kind of have a bit of showmanship to draw their attention on this role, and then you have to be excited for the outcome. Like, whatever it does happen has to be the best possible outcome, or the most exciting possible outcome, pass or fail.
Yeah, I would say being excited about the outcome, I think, is more important when you're rolling out in the open than behind the screen, because there is a danger, I think, of seeming like an uncaring or like nonchalant GM who's like, yeah, the dice are going to tell me what happens, and then, you know, we'll see what happens, and if you guys are screwed, you guys are screwed, because like that's how the dice went.
Yeah, you don't want it to be like, well, I had a really cool thing planned, but you didn't roll the right way and I just rolled it randomly, so you don't get it, sorry, haha, here's a lame outcome instead.
Yeah, like, well, you guys sucked at perception today, so there you go.
Yeah, exactly, no adventure, sorry. Come back next week.
Or don't.
Right. I don't care. I'm just here to eat pizza. I don't like this GM. Who is he?
His name's Chad.
Yeah, his name's definitely Chad.
Also, this is relevant to my interests, and I think, Shane, yours as well. Players, if you are in a game where the GM is rolling in the open, I think that it's basically an invitation to make sure that, mechanically speaking, your characters are as effective as they can be. Because when the dice are going to land in front of everyone, you want to eke out, you want the odds in your favor as much as possible. I'm not saying, you know, oh, you should min-max, but I'm saying that a game where the GM rolls in the open can be a lot of fun for a group of min-maxers, a group of not necessarily power gamers looking to break the game, but people who enjoy the very tactical side of the game, people who enjoy the fact that their characters are effective at what they do and then, you know, work together very well and build combos. Because sometimes if someone's rolling behind the screen, you're never 100% sure if, like, you know, everything that you did to eke out that one more AC really paid off,
right?
10% of the time.
Right, right.
But in front of the table, you can look at it and go, oh, that was worth it. That was successful. Like, the math can really pay off for a particular kind of player in this kind of game.
Yeah, and also as a GM, I think it's, if you have characters or you have players who have specialized in defensive abilities, this is almost a way to just reward them, right? Because it does feel weird as a player if you invest in defense and you are never sure whether or not the GM just happens to be rolling high enough to hit you, and that seems improbably high, or if these are very difficult enemies, or what's going on, right? So it's a way of rewarding defensive players for choosing that specialty just by giving them a chance to see, like, how many dice rolls are they actually negating with their investment.
Yeah, or those spellcasters who have jacked up their save DC.
Oh yeah, saver suck spells are some of the worst, actually, for this, because it's like, well, wow, you really did roll an 18. There's not a whole lot I can do about it. But also, it's like, Well, I'm glad that you didn't just say no, banishment didn't work, because otherwise, like, we would roll this encounter in two parts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as a GM, you're sort of faced with, well, you saw me roll a one on that saving throw.
Exactly.
I guess the encounter's over.
Exactly.
So, yeah, actually, go with fewer solos.
Yeah. Yeah, that's also part of it. You know, design your encounters knowing that you can't fudge out the big bad.
Yeah. Legendary saves in 5e.
Super helpful.
Yeah. Backup in pretty much any system.
Yep. Refractor fields in 40k.
You know, 15% chance is a 15% chance.
Right. Go ahead and take that plus 60 to dodge.
And lean heavily on the wog.
Right.
How did that happen? Orc magic.
Yeah, orc did it. So as we kind of draw some conclusions here about rolling in the open, I think the first thing to keep in mind, if your game isn't broken, don't fix it. You know, like, rolling in the open is fine, and I think it's a way that we do it in some games and don't in others, and all of our games work out fun. So I don't think it's a better way of doing it. It is an alternative, but, you know, if you're worried that it won't be well received at your table, don't. That's fine.
Yeah, or, you know, try it in a one-shot, or try it in a vignette that has fewer consequences than the actual plot of the story.
Yeah.
You know, use it in one tense situation where, again, the consequences aren't going to be the worst thing if things go awry.
Well, won't be the worst thing for your campaign planning, right? Because that's really what it matters is, don't screw up my notes.
But maybe some character's mom dies.
Right. Well, you know, or your rogue trader. I do think it's just a generally useful thing to have in your GM toolkit if you do happen to play like a lot of like impromptu games, or you don't always play in a consistent place or environment. Like if you end up kind of in a strange arrangement where you don't have a screen, or everyone at the table is sharing dice, like I know this happens sometimes at conventions, you know, you just don't have a screen to carry around with you all day. It can be helpful if you kind of know how this works, right? You can expose your dice to the table and you're already sort of working within that framework from the beginning.
Yeah, and if you're going to do this, make sure that you know your players. Tearing down the GM screen, tearing down the wall between you and the rest of the table can really foster collaboration. But for some players, it also destroys the mystery of what's happening. You know, obviously there are some players who prefer to see it and feel like it really does build that camaraderie. But others want to know that the GM has like a firm grip on the reins of the game, because that's why they're there.
Right. You're here to play the GM's game, not the dice's game.
And players, if your GM wants to try this out, or is making a suggestion at the table, you can help it along by making sure that you're not overly nitpicky, right? If you know you have rules lawyer tendencies and are already arguing over dice rules that you can't even see, make right. sure that you're not taking that to the next step when you're like, wait, but that's a 7.
Right.
Are you telling me that they have a plus 14, but we are only level 12, and there's no way that their proficiency bonus can be higher than a plus 4? Sure, they have the high ground, but that's a plus 1 at best.
Objection. Objection.
You don't see in his sheet, his class is Jedi.
He's got feats and he knows people.
I took contacts.
Yeah, so again, it is a fun technique, one that I think everyone should try out. And if it works for you, that's awesome. It has definitely worked for us. Do you hear that, Ishan?
That's me with the higher ground. You know you can't win.
Nope, so I'm going to need another one since I just got bisected. Time to move on to the Character Creation Forge. Before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sense Carne. That's Malice minus Meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrillCast.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building the Holy Roller.
So an evangelical.
Yeah, no.
Slain in the Spirit Guardians.
No, so the Holy Roller is a man of the gods who trusts his deity to guide the dice or the cards or just the tide of battle in his favor. Not quite as cavalier as the gambler, but never doubts his ability to deliver divine grace.
So this is a build for Wednesday night bingo at church.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
Social Security, I'm going to rake it in.
Exactly. Okay, so given that the Holy Roller is a gambler by nature, obviously we're going to start halfling, because you get to reroll those ones with halfling luck.
And also you can hide behind people that you have swindled.
Right.
Okay, so what is the build?
So the build is Lorebard 3, Divine Soul Sorcerer 6, Celestial Blade Warlock 9, and Divination Wizard 2.
Okay, I like it. Lorebard 3 gets all of the bard goodies. Expertise, maybe that's in a gaming set, maybe that's in Deception, or maybe it's just Insight. You also get Cutting Words, so you can, a few times a day, use Bardic Inspiration to reduce an attack roll, an ability check, or damage coming at you by a d6.
Then the Celestial Blade Warlock will get you full Pact Weapon invocations. You can get the new ones like Improved Pact Weapon and Eldritch Smite, all of the options for the Warlock, as well as Healing Light, which is a pool of 10 d6s to share amongst your friends for healing as a bonus action.
That makes people more amenable to playing cards with you.
Right. And then you also get Radiant Soul at level 6, which gives you resistance to radiant damage and allows you to add your charisma modifier to the damage for a spell that causes radiant or fire.
And you have a lot of those.
Yeah.
6 levels of Divine Soul Sorcerer gets you the option to choose divine magic, cleric spells, rather than your sorcerer spells. So you get things like Bless. You can get Bane if you decide that you're going to have Chaos Affinity, which, why wouldn't you?
Right.
Favored by the Gods gets you a juicy plus 2d4 on a failed saving throw or an attack once every short rest. And Empowered Healing lets you top off your tank more effectively.
Yeah, you can spend a sorcery point to reroll any of the dice that an ally is rolling for healing, which will also apply to your Healing Light ability as a warlock. And then Divination Wizard, of course, this is the one we're always looking for. Portent at 2nd level lets you roll 2d20s after a long rest, and you can sub them out for other d20 rolls throughout the day.
As for feats, we highly recommend Lucky. Love this on any build that likes to play games of chance. I will say, this is a halfling, so there's that halfling feat, Second Chance. I think Lucky is better than Second Chance.
And then in terms of leveling order, we would start Bard 3, then take Sorcerer 1, because that gets you both Divine and Arcane casting, then take Warlock, finish it off at level 9, finish off your levels of Sorcerer, and then I think as a capstone, I like taking Portent. So then take your Divination Wizard as your last 2 levels. So Ishin, who is your Holy Roller?
My Holy Roller is kind of like a Fantasyland televangelist, but not a terrible person. So
not Joel Osteen.
Right. Although maybe similar, not similar tactics, a similar goal-ish. So they've been called. They know they must.
Wait, yeah. Tax evasion?
Yes.
Okay.
Wait, no, it's not a monk or a high enough rogue. No, they don't get evasion. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but tax evasion.
Reduce incoming taxes by 1/2.
Oh,
yeah,
that's
exactly.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
reaction.
Okay, yeah. Right, yeah.
It does say damage, and it hurts my pocketbook.
Right, exactly.
So they've been called to build a church, but churches are expensive. I don't know if you know this. It takes a lot of money. 10% of most people's incomes, in fact. So my Holy Roller, she's a good person. She doesn't want to swindle old people out of their meager life savings. Instead, she says, you know what? There are other people I could be swindling. Worse people I could be swindling.
Okay.
Who really aren't doing good things with that money. So I am going to go out into the world and I'm going to find these games. I'm going to go to the casino planet in The Last Jedi.
Right.
And instead of running around on strange camel dogs, okay, I'm going to actually play the games.
Oh.
And win.
And have your game ruined by strange camel dogs.
Oh, perhaps, yes. But of course, when I do win, I'm not going to then use my chips as bullets. I will cash them in for money and then buy cheaper bullets.
Right.
And then, you know, you can't make an entire living out of this, and especially if you want to be an adventurer. It turns out that dungeons often have very expensive things in them.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. So you use your abilities. She hops onto a party and says, "You want to do some spelunking? Yeah, I can do that. All for a higher purpose, to get a bunch of money and build a big building, a big pretty building for the second coming of Thayar's Dune."
Nice.
Because, yeah.
Right. Because you can't have nice things.
Okay. Who is your holy roller?
So my holy roller is actually like an alternate to the bard, I guess, in sort of the classical role sense. I'm thinking someone like Stephen the Irishman from Braveheart, right? You can speak to your deity and those kind of things, right? You have a celestial patron who has access to gods and different things. But you're leading from the front, right? I mean, you are fundamentally a soldier. So you wade into battle with other soldiers and you have to reinforce them, right? You have to maintain their morale and help lead them to success. But when the battle is done and you've made camp, there's a lot of downtime to kill as a soldier. So you might as well be good at gambling. That is kind of, you know, the soldier's game. So if every battle is gambling with your life, then every evening is just gambling away your paycheck.
And if you're going to take someone's money, it may as well be the Scots.
Right. Do I get to kill the English? Excellent.
It's my island.
Well, then why do you need to gamble? Don't you have a whole island? It's good ante, you know? We begin with one island apiece.
Right. All right. Before we wrap up, we do want to take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
And if you check out that website, you will see a link to the Character Creation Forge, where you can find the Holy Rollers build documented for you in a spreadsheet.
Also, you can leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. It'll help other people figure out who the heck we are, and I'm pretty sure that most of the places that people listen to podcasts take iTunes ratings into consideration when figuring out who to display next. And if you do that, we will read your 5-star review on the air. So this one is a solid RPG advice podcast for players of all shapes, sizes, and morphologies from Argetlam. 5 stars. I started listening to Total Party Thrill just before they wrapped up the Morning Glory recaps and managed, through mainlining the show through 8.5-hour workdays, to catch up well before episode 100. Just ignore the fact that it took me this long to review here. I forget things. Every Thursday morning, I add the new episode to my MP3 player, because I am old and I like old tech that doesn't require an always-on internet connection, and sit back in the knowledge that at least an hour of my workday is accounted for. I especially enjoy the Character Creation Forge, because if you look at my 4E character builder folder, you would see that this is exactly the same thing that I do. 458 unplayed but fully built characters and counting. Send help. Keep up the excellent work. 458 is a lot, Shane.
Yeah, but I believe the Zune by Microsoft can hold at least 500 characters.
Everyone on Earth is using it.
So thank you for the review, Argetlam. So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about failing forward.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building the one-hit wonder.
Well, that's it for episode 132 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.